Okay. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Session 2. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm going to be your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online technical resources for vapor intrusion mitigation produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Let's cover some of our housekeeping rules for today. This training, like I said before, will be recorded and will be offered on demand through CLUIN for those not able to join us live. The CLUIN training page offers the slides for you to download under Download Training Materials. Use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time during today's training. We will have a question and answer break about halfway through as well as at the end. And then we do have a third one halfway through the middle one and the end one. For those of you interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box that you certify you participated, that certificate will be provided to you via email. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website. On our website, you can register for teams and learn about how you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on ITRC's website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review the policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products. On slide 4, I have the pleasure of introducing our trainers today. All of them served as members of the VIM team and volunteered to support the training offered today. And on slide 5, I'm going to pass this off to Kelly Johnson from North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. Take it away, Kelly.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Again, my name is Kelly Johnson. I'm with the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. I'm in the Brownfields program as a vapor intrusion specialist. Welcome to today's session 2 training. Of course, if you missed session 1 for any reason, there are recordings of it, and there'll be future presentations as well. Today, the three items we're going to go over is the active mitigation, passive mitigation, system verification, and OM&M and exit strategies. And there's a more thorough introduction as well on session 1. And for today, we'll just do a brief background on the vapor intrusion mitigation training team. We'll talk about the overview of available documentation. We'll talk about how to access the mitigation strategies information, and we'll also identify the sections that will be discussed in today's session. At the bottom right there is a link to the ITRC Vapor Intrusion Mitigation Training Team webpage. You can go to that address there, or you can also access it through the ITRC website. And on there is an interactive directory, which is actually what's on the right side of your screen there. And there's clickable boxes, the fact sheets and checklists. You can click those. It'll take you straight to the document, and there should be a return to home page, so you can get straight to the item that you're trying to look at specifically rather than look at the entire document. And in there, there's fact sheets, technology information sheets. There's a flow chart for the vapor intrusion mitigation conceptual site model development that's covered in session 1. There's also considerations and impacts of various vapor intrusion mitigation approaches. And there's checklists and additional supplemental information that's very valuable. And again, you can click on any of those, get to what you need. You can print it and move on from there. Doesn't really quite like to go to the next slide quite right. And just a real brief overview about vapor intrusion. you know, contaminants in soil or in soil and groundwater, they can volatilize into soil gas. Of course, you have to have a release of a hazardous substance at some point in time or a migrating plume onto your site. But vapor intrusion occurs when these vapors migrate upward into the overlying structure and contaminate indoor air and pose a health risk. Now, there's two subsets of vapor intrusion. There's chlorinated vapor intrusion, which primarily addresses the chlorinated compounds. And then there's petroleum vapor intrusion, which is a subset of vapor intrusion that deals exclusively with the petroleum hydrocarbon contaminants. There's a 2014 petroleum vapor intrusion guidance from ITRC you can reference. And for mixed or commingled plumes and things like that, typically you'll just use the chlorinated vapor intrusion approach. You can go with the 2007 guidance or using some of the mitigation approaches outlined here. And for vapor intrusion mitigation, what's its purpose? It's implemented to reduce indoor air contaminants due to vapor intrusion below applicable action or screening levels. And it's important there to stress that it has to be due to vapor intrusion, either through pathways or through the structure itself. And this can be accomplished by modifying the vapor intrusion pathway to reduce the max flux of contaminants entering the building, or reducing indoor air contaminant concentrations by removal, such as rerouting the vapors around the structure, dilution, such as adding makeup air, something like that, and also diffusion by adding a vapor barrier. And sometimes many vapor intrusion mitigation approaches typically employ a lot of these measures combined as needed. So in a little more detail about what VI mitigation and the volatile organic compound vapor control, kind of the overview of some of the options on it. You know, you can have source remediation, which is where you go and actually tackle the source and reduce the concentrations and hopefully also reduce the amount that can volatilize into soil gas and make its way into a structure. There are some remediation techniques that can have positive effects, like such as depressurize below a structure for other means, and that is covered in session one. Active or passive mitigation is probably the most common approach for vapor intrusion mitigation, and that tackles the building envelope itself, below the slab as it interfaces with the soil. And typically, it's either through putting a barrier to as a diffusion to stop it from getting into the structure or through rerouting it around the structure. Rapid response actions are typically employed in short-term measure. That can include like air filters and things like that, or HVAC modifications. And that's also discussed in session one if you missed that. And lastly, there's institutional controls like land use restrictions that can be placed on a site so that future tenants or buyers can know what to do to make the building safe as it goes forward. A real general overview of the vapor intrusion mitigation process. You'll start with a pre-system installation items, which will include the assessment of the site conditions. You'll look at the technology selection and see what's the best options. And then you'll develop and document the system design. And of course, some of these will depend on your local regions or your agencies that have oversight over the site. For system installation, you'll have a pre-construction meeting where you go over all the process and especially stress at how important this component can be to making sure that the building is safe. You'll, of course, do the installation, and also incredibly important is the installation oversight throughout the entire process. And post-system installation includes system verification, which is additional inspections. You'll have verification sampling of different scales, and then confirming the performance QA/QCs. You'll have documentation to ensure that you did all this properly, and it's done up to code as appropriate in your local region. And then there'll be ongoing operation, maintenance, and monitoring components. Sorry there. Of course, there on the top, you'll see session one, some of the items we covered there, the conceptual site model, public outreach, the rapid response, and remediation and institutional controls. Today, what we're coming up is session two here, and that's active mitigation approaches, the passive mitigation approaches, and the system verification, OM&M, and exit strategy. And it's my pleasure to pass this off to Catherine Regan with ERM for the active mitigation approaches.
Great, thanks, Kelly. Let me make sure I've got control of the screen here. And I do. Okay. Great. Well, thanks. Like Kelly said, my name is Catherine Regan, and I was a part of the VI mitigation team with ITRC, and I worked specifically on the parts of the document or the guidance documents that we created for active mitigation. So today we're going to go through and provide an overview of active mitigation and review a high-level review of the contents of the documents that we developed that were specific for the active mitigation technologies. So we will first want to put everyone on the same playing field and set the definition that we used on what we consider to be active mitigation when we were developing the documents. And then we'll provide an overview of some of the various active approaches that we covered in our team. And then just very few of the key design considerations for active mitigation. And then of course, where in our documents you can find more information. All right, so active mitigation, this is the definition that we used, is the continuous diversion of vapors from under the building through piping to the atmosphere where they can be vented. And the key here is via mechanical means like a fan or a blower. And this mechanized feature is what is defining this as being active. And the other part that would make this active is this ability to be able to take physical measurements. So they're easy to determine effectiveness. And some of those measurement types are the ones that are listed on this slide, like vacuum and flow within the piping, or differential pressure, which you may have heard of already before, which is that measurement that's taken across a slab, which is the vacuum or pressure under a slab relative to the indoor air space. So where I want to start in the active mitigation documentation is our overarching fact sheet that we call the active mitigation fact sheet. And this document was our summary guide to the content of all the other work products that we created that are part of the active work products. So this fact sheet has some quick summaries of the technologies that we felt were common enough to create technology information sheets or tech sheets. And I'm going to go over those in a little bit. But we also had a couple of shorter, quick descriptions of some of the lesser common technologies that you may encounter that are also active approaches. And this document also has numerous references to some of the documents Kelly just mentioned, some of the ITRC documents like the 2007 and 2014 ones and different locations within those documents where you can find mitigation information. And we also reference things like the ANSI and AARST standards. If you're looking for details to actually design a system, you might get some more detailed specific information on actual design specifications in those. Sorry, my screen is delayed. Okay, so I want to jump right into one of our first tech sheets. And all of our tech sheets are laid out in the same format where we go through first this general design, then going through some of the components of this particular approach, some pros and cons, and then some possible cost implications. So each of these tech sheets has this information. I'm just going to go over sort of a broad brush of each of these four common technologies, and of course more information is in each of these tech sheets. So this first one is subslab depressurization. And this is when you draw air from beneath the slab to some sort of collection point, like a suction point. It goes through a riser pipe and then is vented into the atmosphere. And notice the fan placement in these two figures here, the fan may be placed outside of a building, or if it's placed inside of a building, it needs to be outside of the occupiable building space, outside of the insulated unit of a building. Typically, these units are thought to be retrofits on existing buildings, but they could be used in building construction if that's something that's feasible for a building. These are often coupled with other things like crack sealing to help increase the effectiveness or efficiency of a system or extend its propagation of the vacuum under a slab. These are definitely the most common and most conservative mitigation methods. And time and again, there's thousands of these across the country and across the world. These are shown to be very effective active mitigation approaches for sure. So the components of the system, not too elaborate here. There's a fan, there's some measurement equipment, either a manometer, maybe some vacuum gauges, maybe some pressure sensors, or even some pressure switches. There's of course piping and vents and valves. There may be emission control equipment. Now that's going to be highly variable depending on your state or the size of your system or the size of your building, or just the emission permits that are in the particular area where your project is. Maybe a larger system may need emission controls, but a smaller or residential system wouldn't. Same thing with condensate knockouts. There are advantages and limitations to this system, and those are in the tech sheet. I may end up talking about some of these during the presentation, but we didn't specifically lay them out on the slides, but certainly you can look at those as well as the cost piece in the tech sheets themselves. So sub-sab depressurization systems, as I mentioned before, are thought mostly on existing buildings as retrofits, but just wanted to mention quickly that they could also be considered for new construction. And the advantage here, there's one of the advantages, is that you obviously have a lot more control over the material in which it is being installed when you have control over the construction of the building. So, you know, for example, the subgrade material, the gravel that it's put into, the void space that it's put into, you have that kind of control. You also have control over whether a membrane is put in and how robust that membrane is in your building construction. Perhaps that membrane doesn't need to be as robust if you're planning on activating a system versus maybe doing passive mitigation first, for example. And also you have the ability to rough in the system, right? Lay the pipes, stub up the vent stack, not necessarily put a fan on it, but just put the system in while you're building the building in case you're going to need it for later use. And, you know, ultimately that just leads to some positive cost impact. A roughed-in system is going to be cheaper than a system that you put in later as a retrofit. And in addition, you might have more efficiency of a system that you were able to have control over the way that it's put in from ground up than one you have to add in later, and you don't necessarily have all the control of where the piping goes. So you may be able to eliminate the need for a larger system or multiple extraction points to obtain adequate coverage if you're able to control the way that it's put in when the building is being constructed. If you have the luxury of that kind of choice, that is, the building's already here, you know, you have to deal with a retrofit as it happens. So logistically, if you wait till after the building is constructed, you'll also need to deal with the fact that the building is being used and you'll need to install a system potentially on weekends or at night so you're not disrupting ongoing business. So there's a lot of advantages to installing these systems or even just installing them just in case when you're doing new construction. So the next tech sheet I want to talk about is subslab venting. And this is just, it's a variant of subslab depressurization. It's very similar in that it still draws out vapors from under the slab and out and vented into the atmosphere. But as you can see in this little cartoon picture on the right here, those vapors may be drawn out from either a very permeable layer under the slab or, like in this picture here, are drawn out from a void space under the slab. And drawing out of these vapors will reduce concentrations below the slab, and ultimately that mitigates the vapor intrusion issue. So due to that relative ease of drawing out vapors under the slab where you might not have any just a total void space or just very easy permeability with gravel, and also the potential that there's going to be dilution air that gets introduced into that space, these systems in some cases will show less vacuum generation than a subslab depressurization system. And for that reason, the performance metrics that you use to measure if this system is working may be slightly different than you use for subslab depressurization. So you can see on this slide, some of these performance measurements that we have listed here may be things like vapor concentrations or mass flux or air velocity. It may not be just subslab depressurization like we see often with a subslab depressurization system. So typically these are used when there's high permeability subslab materials, as I mentioned, either that's already present or again, you're in a new construction and you have a lot of control over that layer and you can create it yourself. Like we have on this next picture here, on this picture, you can see picture on the right, there's a building being put down. Those little black domes are all interconnected void spaces, and the concrete slab is being poured on top of them. So they'll create a void space under the slab here. So for components, as I mentioned before, the components for a subslab venting system are very similar to subslab depressurization. There's still a fan, there's still piping, there's still venting of the air into the atmosphere. One difference here is potentially these will incorporate this aerated floor system. And oftentimes that's a new construction. Although I will say you could always take a concrete floor in an old building, dig it out and put in a new one to allow for the creation of a void space. Or I've seen a floor being put on top of an old floor, a new floor being put on top of an old floor, and the space in between being that void space. So that can also happen. So I want to bring us next to our first knowledge check. So I think, Devin, there might be a poll that you're opening. All right, let me just move the poll off my screen. There we go. Okay, so I have two scenarios here, scenario A and scenario B. And I want, based on what we've talked about so far, which condition do you think is more amenable to a subslab venting system? Is it scenario A, where you have a concrete floor and there's a high permeability gravel layer under the slab? Or is it scenario B, where you have a concrete floor and there's a low permeability native material under the slab? Which one do you think subslab venting would be a possible mitigation approach for? Just give a couple of more seconds here. All right, let me bring us to the answer. I think many people have already typed it in. It's, of course, it's scenario A, right? Where we have a high permeability gravel layer, kind of led you down that one, under the floor. That's gonna be more of a subslab venting scenario. And to be honest, you can have a mitigation system that is sort of a combination, right? That there's some depressurization going on and there's also some venting going on. And that likely is the case when you have a gravel layer under the floor like that. So I wanna dig into that scenario a little bit more. That scenario A, where you have this high permeability material under the slab, and how would you want to evaluate the performance of that subslab venting system? So in this example here, if I have this suction point, and if I were just to measure the induced vacuum from that point as a differential pressure, and this system was running predominantly as a venting system, you know, I'd still see some differential pressure. I may see it. Oh, I forgot I have animation here. So this may not work. There we go. I may see some differential pressure out this far from the suction point, but that's as far as I would see it. But knowing this is a venting system, I might want to use some of these other methods to check my performance. So maybe I use something like tracer testing. So maybe I inject a helium tracer at various distances from the suction point, and I check to see if I can detect the helium at my suction point. I may see influence of this point, you know, even further out from that suction point and the differential pressure. Again, the suspense. Need to get this thing to go forward. There we go. I may see a tracer test travel time being influencing this bigger green circle out there. And I could also maybe check air velocity. Maybe I can check the velocity of if I can see air movement under the slab. That doesn't necessarily show up as vacuum, but just air movement under the slab, I may actually see that this suction point has an influence that's even this big under the slab. So really the whole point here is that differential pressure may underestimate the actual effectiveness of a subslab venting system, and you may need to use other parameters to show that your system is working, or as you're designing it, you may need to have fewer suction points for a venting system because the influence is actually larger than what differential pressure will show. So the next tech sheet I want to go through is the submembrane depressurization tech sheet. And this again is very similar to subslab depressurization, but except there is no slab. This system is installed with a membrane instead, and then the vapors are drawn out from underneath that membrane, and that's what creates the depressurization. So this would be a preferred method in, say, a crawl space because then the vapors are intercepted before they enter the crawl space and then are routed out out of the slab and up through the atmosphere. Again, this fan could be, this picture only shows it in this unoccupiable attic space, but of course the fan could be outside in this scenario too. Just ran out of room on the slide to show both pictures. This membrane provides a sealed space and is considered when impermeable surfaces are just not possible. Maybe we don't want to or can't pour a concrete floor into this crawl space area. So this would probably be best used for earthen floors, or maybe it's for a really, really deteriorated concrete floor. That may be a typical scenario. Oftentimes this will be more for residential use, although I'm up here in New England and there are certainly some very old manufacturing buildings that have very large earthen crawl spaces here. And that is something that certainly would be a viable option for those types of buildings too. There's no reason why it couldn't, it's just a lot bigger. So the components, again, very similar to SSD, but with the key factor being you have a membrane now, and that membrane needs to be sealed to the walls like it is in this picture. There's some batting being used here to seal this membrane to the walls of this little crawl space. And then there's some place, a collection point. I think it's that little white pipe in the background. There's a collection point where the vapors would get drawn to and then out and vented to the atmosphere here. All right, the fourth tech sheet that we've done, the last one we did was for crawl space ventilation. And it's the last tech sheet here because it really is sort of the last option that we would necessarily want to choose for a crawl space. And really it would be for a crawl space that we just can't access, to put in a membrane, to put in a floor, to do something else too. And the reason it's sort of the last option is because it's not preventing the vapors or the potential for vapors to enter that crawl space. Vapors still get in, but then it's using a fan to dilute and draw those vapors out and vent them outside, and then using dilution to sort of dilute that area and mitigate the potential for vapor intrusion into the living space above. So that process of constantly moving air and drawing air in and out of that crawl space has the unfortunate disadvantage of potentially causing some heating loss or cooling loss in the ground living space above it, which in some place, like again, where I am up here in New England, that can also cause frozen pipe issues, for example, if it gets real cold and the air you're bringing to that crawl space gets real cold. So sometimes these systems will also need to have the added feature of a heater, like you can see in this little cartoon graph here, and maybe even a temperature sensor to know when to turn on and off that heater. So these are not as common for crawl space mitigation as the other technologies, but because they're just simply not as efficient, but they are available if needed, if you just simply can't access a crawl space, it's too small to be able to get in there. So like I mentioned, here are the components. Again, very similar components, but with the added feature of there being maybe some temperature sensors or heaters that would be needed to help with that crawl space and with those potential pipe freezing issues. One other thing I'll mention is that the flow of air through these pipes as you're venting this space, which may be a very low flow, you may not be able to measure a vacuum in that pipe. It may just be some flow measurements that you can take from that pipe. Okay, so those are our four most common technologies that we wrote some tech sheets for. So those are the end results, where you want to end up as an operating active mitigation approach. But how do we get there? And that's where Kelly kind of alluded to this process, these VI mitigation processes that we created. We created some process fact sheets to help summarize each of the steps to get through from design to install to O&M to potentially eventually shut down. So what I'm going to go through here is some of the considerations to be thought about when you're planning the design of an active mitigation system. So let me bring you back to the document map that Kelly showed earlier. So we were, don't know if you can see my mouse, but we were in the active mitigation, that orange square in the middle with our overarching fact sheet and then our four tech sheets underneath it. And now we're moving down to sort of those gray boxes to the bottom. And one of them is the design consideration fact sheet. So here's where we're going to talk about the design process considerations for active mitigation. And then in a little bit, you'll go through some of the other processes about installation and verification, and then O&M and exit strategy after that. So the design consideration fact sheet is a guide through many of the considerations. We're not going to go through all of them today, but many that can be thought about when you're doing various types of mitigation, not only active, but passive and rapid response as well. And we took those considerations and we sort of rated them as to whether they're particularly important to one approach, maybe not as important to others. So this document is not created to help you choose what technology you're going to use. We assumed you already have chosen, and this is just to help you or help a reviewer of a work plan understand what considerations may have gone into a design so they can help review the work plan or can make sure that you've covered all of your bases. So one thing to not forget is that during this design process, you're always still thinking about the vapor intrusion conceptual site model that was talked about in the first session, and that you're also looking forward, making sure that your design also incorporates the next step. How are you going to operate your system to verify that it's doing what you said it's going to do? And that also that you have some way to figure out and plan that it could be turned off someday. How are you going to make sure that that's a possibility in your design? So it's important for the design to sort of look backwards and forwards at the same time. So again, like I said, this was written for all the different mitigation approaches. I'm just going to go through a few factors that you should take into consideration in a design that are particularly important and potentially even unique to the active approach. So the first one is talking about building conditions. And the building type that you have. So one of those building types, of course, and we said this already, is a new construction. So whether a building is new or about to be constructed, or if it's already existing, is going to have a major impact on your design strategy, of course, for an active mitigation system. I mean, the components that you put in to a system for a new construction than for an existing building are going to be very different. Oftentimes, if you're doing a new construction, you may be combining your active mitigation design along with some passive mitigation technologies as well. Or the passive mitigation is going to be the primary approach and your active system is just going to be roughed in, like I mentioned before, and maybe activated at a later date. But if your building is an existing building, well, then there's going to be a lot of other considerations that you're going to have to focus on. And a bunch of them are listed on this slide. So your foundation type, or in particular, if you have multiple foundations, likely from a building being added onto time and time again over the decades, that's definitely going to influence your design. And maybe you're going to need multiple different systems to address each of those different foundations or slabs. That slab integrity, you know, this picture has some sealed floor cracks in the picture. Slab integrity is going to be important. Maybe you have to design in that the slab is sealed during installation. Maybe you need to even seal the slab before you even start because the slab needs to be sealed in order for you to do a successful diagnostic test. The HVAC system is going to need to be reviewed. How is your system going to overcome an HVAC system if present with your design? And then more common environmental factors like soil permeability or maybe an extremely shallow depth to water that also may impact your design. But other things that we don't often think about when we're doing other types of environmental remediation, things like architectural features into your environmental design, into your mitigation system, you know, the exterior facade of a building, requests from the building owner to make sure your vent stack fits in with not only their building, but that it also meets your requirements to be separate from other building openings. You know, that's going to impact your design and the routing of your piping, of course. One of the other important design considerations or that you do prior to design for that's pretty unique to active mitigation is sub-slab diagnostic testing. And this is important for designs in existing buildings. So the most common subslab diagnostic test that we do is one we call pressure field extension testing. Maybe you call it communication testing. Maybe it's called radiative influence testing. It's sort of all generally the same thing. You're measuring differential pressure across the slab from one common suction point. How far can you measure that differential pressure? And again, this is, you know, typically for subslab depressurization systems. And again, maybe not necessarily warranted for a system that's going to be a venting system. So using these diagnostic tests also may be highly dependent on the size of your building. If you have a really small building, residential home, maybe you're building it as a design build and you're going to build the system, see how far it goes and keep adding suction points until you complete. You know, there's different reasons why you would or would not do this ahead of time for your design. But what we'd use these for typically is to understand the number of suction points we need to put in, where they're going to go, and the size of the fan. And this picture just shows a very simplified subslab diagnostic testing. We have one common suction point, that white one with the pipe coming out of it towards the right side of the picture. Then there's a shop vac attached to it with a vent that goes outside. We apply a suction on that one point, and then we use this vacuum monitoring tool that you can see in the bottom of the picture and take differential pressure readings at various distances from that one point to see what the influence is of that one point. And that helps us figure out how many locations we're going to have to use to cover this building. The next thing I want to talk about is design documentation. We have it here in the design consideration section because it is going to be an important piece of your design for active mitigation. It's going to be where your design work plan is. And that's a really important document for you because that's going to be where you gather all of the important information, like your design basis, the reason for your mitigation. It's going to be where you're going to explain how vapor intrusion is occurring and therefore how your design is going to be sufficient in meeting the and controlling that vapor intrusion. This is going to be where you put all of your design specifications, your piping layouts, the map with all your suction points on it and your vent stack piping. You may also need to put into this document how you're going to meet the building codes, if that's applicable in whatever city or state that you're in, how you're going to address any permits that you need. Again, very, very project specific, depending on where your project is located, and also for emission permits or emission controls, if that's going to be warranted. This is also the document where you're going to lay out what metrics you're going to use to prove that the system, as it's installed and operating, is meeting the objectives of your design, and also what metrics you're going to continue to collect that you're going to use as part of your ongoing operation, maintenance, and monitoring. I would also say this document is a really good document to use as part of your stakeholder engagement, that communication with whomever that would be, your property owner, the tenants, other stakeholders. This is where you would want to get their buy-in, because then you will know if what you're about to install into that person's building is going to meet their expectations as well as meet the design expectations. So one quick look back at the document map here, because there's one more companion document I just want to highlight, which is this design considerations fact sheet. And then that's what's on the left in the gray. And then we also have this system design and documentation checklist. So the checklist is a companion document to the fact sheet. I'll just highlight on the next slide what that checklist looks like. So the checklist is, again, it's not just for active mitigation, it is for passive as well. And the checklist just provides some information necessary to proceed through the design process. So it is sort of all encompassing, and not every checklist item is going to apply to every single design, but it's sort of a reminder on different aspects and considerations. You know, did you consider this? Did you consider that? Helps you kind of walk through all of them. Some of them you could just say not applicable. Some of them, depending on the size of your design or the size of your project or the building, you may want to click not applicable and then state why it's not applicable to your particular project. So this could be, you know, very long or very short, depending on the complexity of your building or the complexity of your project. But it's there just to help as a reminder. All right. So in summary, we have now gone over what we used as our ITRC VI mitigation team as our definition for active mitigation. And we've gone over the four most common types of active mitigation approaches that we have tech sheets for. We've also gone through a few of the design considerations for active and the tools that we developed to help you through some of those design processes or really help someone review someone's design work plan. And most importantly, I think we've shown you where on that document map you can find more of this information and review more of the details on your own. So the next steps here are, well, we've designed our system, so now let's go ahead and install it, verify that it's working effectively, do the routine O&M, and maybe plan for some exit strategy of having that system shut down. And all these next steps are going to be covered in following modules this afternoon. And now it looks like we've got a question answer break, so I'll return it to Devin.
Thank you, Catherine. All right. We will open the question and answer portion at this time. If you have any questions, please type them into the Q&A pod in the bottom of your screen. We will get through as many of these during the live portion that we can, and any that we cannot get to, our trainers will respond to you in the chat. All right, we have one question right now regarding discussion on slide 26. How do you evaluate sub-slab velocity?
It's a good question. Oh, someone's typing an answer.
That's just me, Catherine. Go ahead.
Oh, no. that is something I'll have to get back to you on that one.
I will not type an answer then. All right. So, Catherine, I guess you'll answer that one in the chat.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me answer these things in the chat. Yeah.
I'll move on with, we have a few more. Can any of these systems be retrofitted to a sanitary sewer that is experiencing vapor issues?
Can any of these, I'm not quite sure what you mean. Any of these systems be retrofitted to a sanitary sewer? Yeah, oh, you mean like not, can you retrofit a sanitary sewer so that it doesn't go, because it doesn't vent into the building? I don't really understand the question.
I guess we'll also answer that one in the chat. We can follow
or
up.
Or can, yeah, Megan, can you type more into what you mean exactly? How do you block a sanitary sewer from venting into a building? Or do you mean, can you route the vapors from one of these systems into a sanitary sewer? I'm not quite sure which one she's trying to say there.
Well, Megan, we'll get back to you on that one. All right, we have a few more. Could you comment about fan blower capacity section? Or selection.
Selection.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that is something that we typically, it's what you would do as part of your sub-sub diagnostic testing. I mean, that's how you figure out, you know, what your flow rate of your fan is and how far out your radius of influence is for different size fans. And really you just need to fit it onto your blower curves. I mean, that's why we do those diagnostic tests, is to figure out what you have in your building and what your fans can handle. I mean, you don't want to put in a fan that has to run at its maximum capacity in order to meet the design specs of your project. You want to put in a fan that has a little bit more oomph left in it so that it doesn't burn out as quickly. So that's why we do the diagnostic testing.
Thank you, Catherine. Megan commented, vapors traveling along a utility envelope, then traveling into a basement.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's not really what we were talking about with these systems that we put into these tech sheets. I mean, I think it's a highly specified, you're talking about diverting sort of a preferential pathway from getting into a building. I suppose as long as you had this system intersecting that pipe envelope, as you called it, then that would work. As long as you're preventing them from going into the building, sure, they could be retrofitted to do that. But you would need to know that that's exactly how the vapors are entering your building.
Catherine, you could also make a point of saying that we need to be sealing utility entrances into a basement. That should be part of the design work, just like sealing cracks in the slab. Utility penetrations are another area where you need to seal up those areas so you can cut off any vapors from migrating into the building.
Right. If that's the reason it's getting in there, then the ceiling should be taking care of that. But if you add that ceiling to one of these systems, then that would solve both problems.
All right. Thank you, Catherine and John. All right. Next question. How does the system deal with areas prone to flooding?
I suppose it matters which system you're talking about. You really can't put a sub-slab depressurization system in an area where the basement's going to flood. I mean, you can, but it's not going to work when it's full of water, right? We've definitely put systems like this in places where the water table will go up and down. And if the water table or the soil gets moist in where the system is, the system basically stops working while that's happening, and then the water table goes back down again and it starts working again. If it's flooding, you possibly could use the aerated floor system. And if the void space is high enough, you'd always still have a void space above the flooding to keep an aerated area that you could vent. Flooding is going to be a tricky issue, and it will depend on how much flooding you're talking about.
I've also seen it as situations where you actually lower the groundwater table as part of the mitigation, or in some cases you raise the floor. Your example, Catherine, about putting in a floor on top of a floor, you create a void space. That sometimes is effective. And I've had other cases where you actually create the entire basement area as one, as removing the vapors completely. You can't access the basement at that point, and we'd seal up the ceiling of the basement. But that's another way. It's an extreme case. But yes, subslab depressurization systems are not very effective when you're dealing with high groundwater table.
John, since I don't know if you can contact Todd on what the air velocity meter is called. I'm totally blanking on it from that first question that was asked. That's something that he would know the answer to, but I can't remember.
Take care of it.
Thanks.
All right, next question. In regards to sub-slab venting, how do you handle rodents? They tend to be problematic in urban areas.
Oh, man. That is a new one for me. I have not had that problem. I guess I'm assuming, Ryan, that you're talking about rodents inside the void space of a venting system. That would be very news to me. I don't know if anyone has experienced this before, but
he commented correct.
Wow. I don't see, well, honestly, like, what's the problem? I mean, the whole void space still exists, and I'm not sure that I mind that the rodents are breathing the air in there. As long as they're not blocking the whole space, I'm not sure that would really affect it.
Thank you, Catherine. Next question. Many of the examples did not show off-gas air treatment. How common would it be that local regulators may require treatment in both passive or active mitigation scenarios?
Oh, I'll let the passive folks answer the passive question when we go through the passive section. But in my experience, off-gas treatment for these types of systems is usually exempt, but I will say usually with a caveat that in California, that is oftentimes not the case. There's different parts of the different states' guidance documents that will guide you as to whether emission controls are needed. And oftentimes it either says that a depressurization system or a mitigation system for vapors is exempt just by definition. Sometimes you have to show that if you have an estimated, pounds per year below X, whatever X is these systems don't need emission controls. And often these systems meet both of those statements. But depending on the size and depending on the state, emission controls could be needed. But the only places I've put emission controls on these systems before is in California. That's just my experience.
And Catherine, usually when you're measuring velocity, particularly in tubes or piping, you use a vane or a hot wire anemometer.
Right. No, it's the subslab velocity, not the ones in the piping, but in the subslab venting scenario, if you wanted to measure airflow velocity in the subslab, I know Todd has done it before, and I just can't remember what he used.
Okay, I'll reach out to him.
Yeah.
I'm on mute. Sorry about that. We can hold that question too to circle back in terms of passive. There's another question comment in terms of the rodent question. Someone asked, rodents can't crawl up into the piping.
You've got me. I mean, you've stumped me. This is a new one. I've never heard of an issue with rodents crawling inside of vapor intrusion mitigation piping.
Catherine, I would think if it was properly installed that there would be no way for the rodents to get into, particularly like a void space to begin with.
I know, that's why I'm like, this is totally new. I've never heard this before. Yeah, how would the rodent in the first place get under the concrete slab? But if they're already in there, could they crawl in the piping? I mean, can they crawl up sheer PVC pipe walls? I don't know. that's a funny one.
Maybe they're really hungry for PVC and like to chew through it.
Yeah.
All right. Keeping in that trend, what about rodents chewing on piping or membranes?
Peter, I'll let you answer the membrane part of that question.
We have not seen it. I mean, it's really hard for a rodent to get to a membrane because you're going to be sitting on usually gravel the majority of the times, and it would have to get into a gravel bed, get through the gravel bed, and then start kind of chewing on it up underneath the concrete slab. I don't think that there's many attractive components to our systems where it would attract a rodent. And I mean, I guess rodents can chew through anything if there's something inside that they want. But, if you're using Schedule 40 or Schedule 80 PVC for your vent piping, I can't imagine them getting through that. Unless there's some cheese in there.
Okay. Next question is.
Sorry, I'm reading ahead.
No, you're fine. Is XP equipment necessary for VI? Could a radon type blower be used, for example, to reduce costs?
I'll answer the second part of that question. A radon type blower, yes. On a simple home, it is essentially a subslab depressurization system. It is essentially a radon system. I mean, it's basically the same, essentially the same thing, but sort of for a little bit different source, obviously different source and a little bit different purpose. So a radon type blower can definitely be used given this in a given situation. Explosion proof equipment, I guess the answer is really, it depends, right? It depends on you can't answer that because I don't know the size of the building, the size of the problem, and the compounds that you're dealing with. So I suppose to get that answer for that part is it depends. But for certain buildings, in particular small residential ones, radon type blowers, for sure.
That wraps up the first question and answer portion. We will have two more throughout the training. And so at any time, if you think of anything, you can put it in the Q&A pod and we will get to it during those live portions. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Jay.
Thanks, Devin. So I'm Jay Eichberger, and today I'll be discussing passive mitigation along with Peter Grant. First of all, we want to welcome you to the passive mitigation approaches portion of the training module and share the content that our subgroup created. Unfortunately, we can't cover all of that today, so we're going to provide an overview of passive mitigation technologies and the mitigation process. Oh, went too far. So during the first half of this presentation, I will define passive mitigation, introduce you to documents our subgroup created, and discuss common technologies and the mitigation process. And during the second half of the presentation, Peter will introduce key considerations for system design, installation, and planning, and we'll end with a discussion of the construction quality control measures. At the end of today's presentation, you should be familiar with a range of mitigation technologies, how to select a mitigation approach for your site, and how to ensure proper system installation. I just want to set a reminder here to make sure that you review and update your conceptual site model often. This will allow the project team to evaluate whether the current site conditions warrant mitigation, and it ensures that the site conditions drive the mitigation selection or drive selection of the mitigation approach. But it's important to note at this point in the process, you've already decided to implement a passive mitigation approach. So with that in mind, let's start with defining passive mitigation. Passive mitigation does not rely on mechanical means such as radon fans or vacuum blowers. And this is achieved by blocking vapor intrusion pathways and relying on natural mechanisms such as chemical diffusion and thermal or wind-induced pressure gradients to divert contaminant vapors through or around a building. Generally speaking, passive mitigation is associated with new construction. We should also touch on public outreach here and remember that anytime mitigation is necessary, it's important to engage with the public. This ensures that the installed mitigation systems are understood and they're not compromised in the future. The information we'll be covering today is based on the passive mitigation fact sheet, and similar to the active mitigation fact sheet, you can think of this document as your guide to passive mitigation approaches. It walks the reader through the mitigation process from start to finish, and it directs the reader to additional resources from ITRC. The passive mitigation fact sheet includes links to 5 technology information sheets and each of those discuss common mitigation technologies in greater detail. When we think of passive mitigation, we usually think of passive barrier systems, and there are 3 main passive barrier systems that we'll be discussing today. These include asphalt latex membranes, thermoplastic membranes, and composite membranes. There are subtle differences between these types of passive barrier systems depending on which materials and installation methods are used, but they all seal the building foundation and block preferential pathways. Ultimately, site conditions will dictate which type of barrier system you're going to use. As someone who sees a lot of plans for mitigation systems, I can tell you that evaluating these systems can be a little confusing at times. So I want to encourage each of you to engage with mitigation vendors and your regulatory contacts when assessing your mitigation options. First, we'll cover asphalt latex membranes, or ALMs. These types of systems consist of a base layer, an asphalt latex core, and a cap sheet. The materials used in the base layer and cap sheet vary, but they usually consist of a thin plastic membrane backed with a geotextile fabric. The base layer provides a surface for the spray-applied asphalt latex to adhere to, and the cap sheet provides protection to the barrier system. The core of the asphalt latex membrane is spray applied and it cures in place, and this provides a seamless layer of protection. The cap sheet creates a bond between the barrier and the concrete slab. The bond that this forms eliminates the need for mechanical fasteners and sealing around penetrations. Remember that the overall thickness of the asphalt latex membrane measured in mils is specified by the manufacturer. Next, we'll discuss thermoplastic membranes. These are typically single layered systems comprised of high density polyethylene or HDPE, but they may consist of a variety of other materials, such as linear low density polyethylene or LLDPE. These types of systems are thicker and more rigid than other types of passive barrier systems, and that additional thickness affects the installation procedures, and it differentiates thermoplastic membranes from common moisture vapor barriers, which are intended solely for waterproofing. During the installation process of a thermoplastic membrane, the sheets are overlapped and the seams are heat welded. Prefabricated boots are used to seal around penetrations, and mechanical fasteners are used to secure terminations at the end of the sheets. This type of passive barrier system is often used in conjunction with a vapor collection system. Due to their thickness, thermoplastic membranes are more puncture resistant compared to other types of membrane systems, and they also offer a high level of chemical resistance. While the material costs are low, the installation process is a bit more labor intensive, and they're typically used in new construction applications. The last type of passive barrier system we'll discuss are composite membranes, which use a variety of materials to create a multi-layered system. The materials used can improve chemical resistance, the constructability, and the durability of the barrier system. I like to say that the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, which means that multiple layers may provide greater protection when they're used in combination with one another versus being used individually. There is a gray area between composite membranes and other types of barrier systems. For instance, both composite membranes and asphalt latex membranes use multiple materials that can reduce diffusion rates of contaminant vapors. The installation methods vary depending on the materials used. As with any mitigation technology, always be sure to follow all of the manufacturer's installation instructions. I can't stress that enough. That's usually where we see deficiencies. So in summary, composite membranes incorporate materials designed to improve chemical resistance. Depending on the combination of materials used, composite membranes offer greater protection using thinner mill systems compared to other types of barrier systems. They can also be used in combination with systems like asphalt latex membranes to provide a high level of protection from chemical diffusion. A few things to keep in mind, however, are that some composite membranes incorporate tape-based seams that may be subject to delamination. And if smooth materials are used in the installation process, they may pose installation challenges due to lack of adhesion to the concrete slab. When considering which type of passive barrier system is right for your site, keep in mind that some states require minimum mill thicknesses, and regulatory approval may be required for newer technologies. These are often associated with composite membrane systems. While passive barrier systems are the most common form of passive mitigation, there are other approaches that also protect against a wide variety of contaminants. These include technologies like aerated floors, passive subslab venting systems, epoxy floor coatings, and building designs such as raised foundations or vented crawl spaces. Aerated floor void space systems use plastic forms installed prior to pouring the concrete floor slab. Once the concrete floor slab is poured, the forms create a void space beneath the floor. In that space, there is very low resistance to airflow because these types of systems don't have to pull vapors through a layer of sand or gravel like other systems. This allows for a high air exchange rate beneath the floor compared to other types of venting systems. The plastic forms are connected to vent risers, which allow vapors from the void space to be discharged at locations above the roof of the building. And while aerated floors rely on passive venting, these systems are often use active means to depressurize the void space, such as a radon fan or vacuum blower. To recap, there's very low resistance to airflow using aerated floors versus other venting systems. This results in low operating costs over time. However, this type of mitigation system is less common in the United States, and it may be less applicable to existing buildings unless a higher floor elevation can be accommodated. Moving on, we'll discuss passive subslab venting systems. These consist of horizontal vent piping installed in a permeable layer of sand or gravel beneath the floor slab, similar to what Catherine discussed. The horizontal vent piping typically consists of perforated pipe or a permeable geotextile matting connected to vertical vent risers. The vapors beneath the building travel through the permeable venting layer into horizontal piping into the vertical vent risers, and they're ultimately discharged above the roof. So this type of venting system relies on pressure differences to introduce flow through the piping, and they're almost always used in combination with the passive barrier. The photo on this slide shows a passive subslab venting system, and you can see that gravel is used to create a permeable venting layer. Horizontal vent piping or a collection network is installed within that permeable gravel layer. The void space or collection plenum is installed, the void space or collection plenum is shown where the horizontal vent piping connects to the vertical vent risers. And the vertical vent riser or exhaust vent, as it's labeled in this example, is connected to the collection plenum. The exhaust vent in this photo is capped to prevent debris from entering the system during the construction phase. Under the right conditions, a passive subslab venting system can capture vapors over a large area. The simple design avoids the need for long-term operation and maintenance and monitoring activities. And compared to active venting systems, a passive subslab venting system may require more vent risers. It also has reduced performance when compared to active venting systems because there's not a fan actively sucking on the system, essentially. So as I stated before, passive venting is almost always used in combination with the passive barrier. It's important to note that in some state regulatory agencies may not allow for passive subslab venting systems as a standalone mitigation option. So what happens if you have an existing structure and you want to use a passive mitigation approach? Well, in those situations, an epoxy floor coating can be applied to an existing floor slab. The condition of the floor slab and the surface preparation can affect the overall quality of the application. The concrete must be clean and dry, and the surface must be scarified for the EFC to bond properly. These types of systems provide a strong, durable, and chemical-resistant barrier, and they can be installed in a variety of building types, and they're easy to clean and maintain. Since they're installed on the top of the concrete slab, damage to the floor coatings is easy to identify and repair. They're also easy to customize and offer a variety of colors and finishes, such as a slip-resistant finish. However, they require a special preparation of the concrete to control moisture content and to prevent delamination. Scarification of the concrete is required to ensure a strong bond with the concrete surface. Remember, if you're using this type of system, an operation maintenance monitoring plan should be in place to address any damages to the epoxy floor coating. The last category of passive mitigation we'll discuss is building design. The design of a structure can be used to prevent vapor intrusion from occurring or mitigate the vapor intrusion risks. For example, parking garages are usually constructed in city settings where space is limited. They're designed to prevent the buildup of vehicle exhaust by increasing air exchange rate within the parking structure. And in some locations, the air exchange rates are specified by building codes. So in these instances, by documenting that the required air exchange rates are being maintained, that may address your vapor intrusion risks for the structure. Next, we'll talk about raised foundations. So other forms of building designs such as raised foundations and vented crawl spaces can address vapor intrusion concerns for smaller buildings. Raised foundations are usually found in warm climates and areas prone to flooding. The use of block and beam construction to raise a building off the ground separates the building from the vapor source and cuts off the vapor intrusion pathway. More often, you'll find houses with crawl spaces than with raised foundations. And the concept used in the parking garage example is the same for buildings with vented crawl spaces, just on a smaller scale. By increasing the air exchange rate within the crawl space, that can help to prevent the buildup of unwanted vapors. And this can be achieved using natural ventilation or passive means, or fans if adequate air exchange rates can't be met. So that would be an active mitigation. More information about building design can be found in the Building Design Technology Information Sheet. Be sure to check with your state regulatory agencies when you're considering the implementation of any of the passive mitigation approaches we've discussed today. So now we're going to go to a knowledge check. And the question is, which mitigation technology is commonly used in combination with a passive barrier system? Your options are A, aerated floors, B, epoxy floor coatings, C, passive subslab venting systems, or D, none of the above. So hold for a moment just to have you guys consider your options. And I think we've got enough answers now. So the group answered C, passive subslab venting systems. And that is the most appropriate answer, but I want to make sure that the takeaway is that a lot of these technologies can be used in combination with one another. It just depends on what kind of site conditions you have. So next I'll turn things over to Peter Grant to discuss the installation of the mitigation systems.
Thanks, Jay. I'm getting control here. I believe I have it. And to quickly recap, we've defined passive mitigation. We've also reviewed the five different passive technologies that one can employ to mitigate vapor intrusion. It's important, though, to reiterate that we've already consulted the CSM, used it as a tool to evaluate all of our site conditions, and conducted that passive mitigation is the best approach to meet our mitigation objectives. So now what? To put this a little more context in this graphic, I've really seen people go down three different paths. One is they literally kind of figure it out as they go. They start building a building, you know, start trying to incorporate into their plans. As you can imagine, chaos ensues. Secondly, a general contractor is given a slip of paper by a consultant and said, hey, you need to put a mitigation system in. The third route is specific plans are developed to show and inform all parties how the mitigation system will be installed. As you can imagine today, we're going to be focusing on the last path. And I really can't stress enough that these systems need to be installed right the first time. And taking shortcuts is definitely not advised. So that's why we're going into depth about all of the planning as well as the implementation process for these systems. The focus of the section is to give you information about the best practices in the design, installation, QA, QC, procedures of passive mitigation. And we've developed at ITRC a number of different resources on this topic for your review. It should be noted that a lot of the design concepts we're discussing can also be applied to active systems. So there is some crossover between passive and active. So let's start by discussing where you can find some more information. The ITRC team created three separate design process fact sheets to assist you with VIMS installation or vapor intrusion mitigation systems. These design consideration fact sheets summarize the key items that you might need to take into account when a mitigation system is implemented, and they will help you address the entire process. They will cover design, installation, verification, OM&M, and monitoring, and finally, exit strategies. Today, we'll only be covering the design process fact sheet outlined on this slide. The other fact sheets, OM&M, and post-installation will be covered in the next module. The design process and considerations fact sheet is the reference guide, is the reference document that I like to point you to for additional information. It's really kind of like your cheat sheet for this whole process. When beginning your VIMS design, it's important to first establish a basis for your design. You know, basically, how did you arrive at the conclusion that passive mitigations is the most appropriate approach for your site? The design basis document first needs to explain how vapor intrusion is occurring based on the CSM, and the explanation should also include what technology or technology you selected and how they will meet your mitigation objectives. The next step is a set of plans needs to be created that documents and reflects the basis of design document. All the different aspects of the selected mitigation approach needs to be reflected in this document. This generally covers product specifications, job specific detail drawings, and most importantly, QA/QC guidelines. I do get this question a lot, basically, why are these plans important? And the reason why they're important is because construction's organized chaos. There's a lot of things and trades that can impact the implementation of these systems. And it's critical that all of the other trades that can impact your mitigation system are on the same page. So it's not just, you know, one or two contractors, really it's the whole project team that can impact the success of these systems. In order to provide this explicit instruction to the construction team, these plans need to be or show detailed drawings of how and where the system will be installed. This is especially important around critical areas such as slab penetrations, membrane termination points, and also the exact details for event system. Those have the most impact on the other components of the building. So when you're talking about your vent system, that means you have to talk about your vent placement, your vent risers and monitoring points. These also, again, need to be identified in your drawings. Performance testing, that can mean many things, and it will vary state by state. It's one of the more hotly debated questions right now. But for example, when we discuss passive barriers, a diffusion coefficient is a good performance testing metric. Diffusion coefficients can help you give you an indication of the product's ability to protect against the chemicals of concern and should be included within your mitigation design documentation. Once the design is complete and prior to the installation of the mitigation system, a VIMS designer should confirm that a pre-construction meeting is planned and that all trades involved in the installation of the mitigation system are present. So the obvious people that this should include is the VIMS designer, product manufacturers, and specialty installers if they're required. But most importantly, this needs to include the general contractor, concrete installer, rebar installer, plumbers, electrical, architect. These are other people that have or trades that have an impact on the success of the system. The pre-con is something that we always encourage primarily because it's a formal review of the site conditions prior to installation. Many times what we see is that site conditions can change, building design can change between the time that these VIMS plans have been developed and the point where they're actually going to be installing it in the field. So the goal is to review the mitigation plans to confirm that they actually reflect the site conditions, and they want to confirm other aspects of the mitigation plan as well. This includes confirmation of substrate requirements, ventilation layout, location of vent risers, as well as utility penetrations. Another thing that's critical to discuss at this point are the QA/QC procedures. These need to be known upfront, primarily because once you install these systems, they're in the critical path of construction, and time is money, as they say. So getting this agreed upon will make sure that they happen. And what they want to agree upon is the frequency and duration of the installation oversight. Again, it's critical that these are requirements are agreed to prior to the start of the installation of the system. At the end of this pre-construction meeting, the general contractor and other trades should have a clear indication of what's needed to install the system and also how to sequence the installation with the other trades on site. taking the time to conduct a pre-construction meeting will dramatically increase the likelihood that these systems will be installed in accordance with the mitigation plans. So back to QAQC, it's something that, again, we stressed is something that's very important. And it's especially important with passive mitigation approaches. Again, the goal is to get it right the first time. These, again, should be incorporated into the design phase of these systems. And there's a number of different QAQC guidelines out there. Many include manufacturer's requirements, regulatory requirements is something that we see quite a bit of, as well as site-specific needs. Some of the more common ways to verify system installation include smoke or tracer gas testing, coupon sampling, and one thing that I think is really important, oversight documentation. Oversight documentation is a formal way of recording that the proper QAQC procedures have been conducted. For example, passive barriers are constructed in the field and applied prior to the placement of concrete. Each barrier system should have installation specifications along with quality control procedures to test the integrity of the seams, seals around pipe penetrations, system termination points, and overall field membrane integrity. An example of a passive QAQC testing protocol you can see in this picture on the right. This is a smoke test that's being conducted. And essentially what happens is they pump non-toxic smoke underneath the membrane to help identify any deficiencies that wouldn't be otherwise identified by the naked eye. When reviewing passive mitigation approaches, there are some considerations for new as well as existing structures. Again, some of the existing structures were covered in Catherine's presentation, but for new construction, a passive mitigation system can be installed and basically designed to be incorporated during the construction of the building. That gives you a lot of freedom because you can work the system around the building that's going to be constructed. For existing structures, the mitigation system design must work around the existing building conditions. And we're going to get into some of the details of each of these in the next slide. It is important to note that some situations may require rapid mitigation of the vapor intrusion pathway. If this does occur on your site, there is a sheet for that as well. It's called the ITRC Rapid Response and Ventilation Fact Sheet. So that would be another reference document for you. Again, if that situation does arise. For new construction, it really provides a clean slate. It makes it easier to properly evaluate and plan for the implementation of your system. Regardless of what type of system is being utilized, planning and construction oversight is a very important step in this process and really required to make sure that the system is installed per design. The planning and resulting vapor intrusion mitigation system design should be used to help coordinate with the project team and subsequent trades, as we discussed earlier. And the design should become part of the building plans to aid in managing the system in the future, especially if adjustments need to be made once the building is in operation. This is also a very handy documentation to have if the builder or the seller, the person that built the property is going to be selling the property in the future. A key advantage to new construction is the ability to combine any passive mitigation systems that we previously discussed in order to create redundancy for the building that's being constructed. With existing buildings, you don't get the flexibility that comes with new construction. As you can imagine, it's going to make the site evaluation and planning more challenging, really due to the fact that the building already exists. And this may limit the amount or the type of passive mitigation technologies that you might be able to incorporate in your structure. The key consideration for incorporating a mitigation system with an existing building is understanding the building foundation and really how it can impact your mitigation design. Building modifications may be necessary in order to incorporate a passive design for an existing structure. And if the original plans of the building don't exist, or let me put it this way, if they do exist, it will help the process become a lot easier in trying to evaluate what mitigation system is the most appropriate. Again, though the building is in place, it might take considerable time to understand how the building foundation might impact any form of mitigation. And Catherine really did a great job of handling this in the previous presentation. So now we're to a knowledge check. We want to give you a quick little test to see how if we've done a good job in understanding or providing a focused explanation of the design process. What is the most important element of a good design? A, figuring it out as you go, skipping the CSM, letting the project team know you want to pass the mitigation system, or D, proper site evaluation and planning. So I see that I imagine people are putting in their answer. It disappeared. Oh my gosh, 99% of the respondents got the right answer. The right answer is D, proper site evaluation and planning. Great job, everyone. I appreciate the one person that said, figure it out as you go. I like a little humor during these presentations. So going on to additional documentation, again, we provide a number of different tools for you to help you through this process. And next checklist that we have, Catherine also had the checklist, is the system design and documentation checklist. It's really designed to prompt you to think about the different aspects of the design process. So while everything might not be evaluated, might be appropriate for all of your site conditions, it's a great place to start to help you walk through the different aspects to passive mitigation. Again, the complexity of the site, this contaminants they're dealing with, might make some things applicable and some things not applicable. But again, it's a great place to start. So what did we learn in this module? We learned a number of things. We defined passive mitigation and how it does not rely on mechanical means to mitigate vapor intrusion. We covered the five major categories of vapor mitigation systems. Then we discussed the key elements of vapor intrusion mitigation system design and how planning is critical to the success of achieving your mitigation goal. Finally, we talked about the importance of construction quality assurance, installation oversight, and the appropriate documentation. Mitigation systems are installed for a reason, and it's important to get it right the first time. So what's next on the horizon? There's other ITRC modules that'll help you better understand the next steps in this process, and these topics are covered in the next section. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it back over to our moderator, and we have some questions. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Jay and Peter. We will now begin our second Q&A portion of today's training. So remember, at any time, you can put those questions into the Q&A box and we will get to them. All right, so starting off, please discuss post-install sub-slab QA testing. It seems the regulators are still pushing this, but there is no sampleable space between the barrier and the overlying concrete slab. Surrogate QA testing, such as indoor air with or without tracers, are prone to false positives and excessive costs. Isn't the smoke testing adequate to satisfy the post-install QA testing requirement?
I'll take an attempt at this. I know we have a number of people that can provide a different perspective. Doing post-monitoring follow-up is one of the things that regulators are looking at throughout the country, and each of them have different things that they like to employ. Most consultants want to try to get away from indoor air sampling. If you are going to do indoor air sampling, I suggest taking submembrane samples and pairing it with indoor samples. The challenge with indoor air sampling is that there's just so many things that can provide a false positive. Depending on where you are, depending on what your contaminants of concern are, if they're PC and TC, even benzene or different variants of benzene, a lot of that stuff can be found in regular building materials. My suggestion is to do subslab sampling first, see what your concentrations are. What many people, I think, discount is the fact that there's also, in the case of using a barrier as well as a venting system and We touched on that earlier. A barrier is most commonly used with some type of venting system. That the venting system, you know, will also be diluting the vapors underneath your slab, as well as expelling them from building up underneath your building as well. That is the quick answer on my view on that. The other thing that, again, what we tried to stress a lot of on the QAQC of the process is you can have more oversight during the construction process. And we didn't get into, you know, all the nooks and crannies of what that might be. But I think that if you have a nice level of oversight or comprehensive oversight during the construction process, you can come out with it having a high level assurance that the system has been installed correctly. I know other people have opinions on this. So does anybody else want to?
I can take a stab at it. What I'm really focusing on in the question is no sampleable space between the barrier and the overlying concrete slab. So I want to get to the heart of the question with this. It really, you know, the performance metric that you're looking at really depends on what you're trying to prove. Are you trying to show that the barrier, the integrity of the barrier is competent and you're not, and there's nothing getting above that? Or are you trying to monitor for breakthrough concentrations for certain contaminants of concern? You know, what I would stress is that it's really important to identify appropriate performance metrics early in the game, you know, during your design process, and talk to your regulators about what performance metrics are appropriate to show what you need to show. So that my suggestion would be to kind of have a good understanding of that beforehand. If that's not possible, or there's a system that's already installed that's not possible for, I would really engage with your regulators to try to nail down what is it you're trying to prove there with that form of data.
All right. Thank you, trainers. Next question. Wouldn't the epoxy floor have as bad of fumes or vapors as the vapors you were trying to avoid?
Good question. It depends on what type of epoxy you're using. There are epoxies out there. We're obviously well aware of one do not contain VOCs. So granted, there are some fumes when installing a VOC-free epoxy coating, but those will, you know, dissipate very quickly. The fumes are not very significant. But the key is to use an epoxy that's free of VOCs.
Okay, thank you, Peter. Next question. For the epoxy floor coating, how well does it work with expansion joints? One building I looked at was cracking at those joints. It was not installed specifically for VI, but couldn't that be a preferential pathway?
Absolutely. Expansion joints are something that need to be treated. There's a number of ways to do an expansion joint with an epoxy coating. And that is also something that needs to be, any type of epoxy coating that's used to mitigate vapor intrusion is going to need some level of continued, I don't want to say oversight, but inspection, because, you know, the epoxy can get damaged over time. The expansion joints, because they're designed to move, I mean, that's exactly what they are. You will need to monitor those over time. But there are a number of different ways to use an epoxy coating for expansion joints.
Okay, thank you, Peter. So keeping in the same trend, for the epoxy floors, is there a concern for off-gassing of the epoxy materia into the environment? Example, inhalation risk. If so, is there a protocol for ensuring that this material will not pose an inhalation risk?
You know, I could chime in for a moment, but I think Peter's probably going to have a better perspective on the application of epoxy floor coatings. I think if it's not a VOC-free product, you're probably going to want to have some ventilation while you're during the installation process. But I think Peter covered that pretty well when he says, you know, a lot of the VOCs will dissipate pretty quickly after the installation process.
Yeah, agreed. And I think we covered that in a previous question, but if you use a VOC-free epoxy, you should be good to go. That could be somewhat of a challenge. I mean, there's thousands of epoxies out there. So you just want to make sure that you're using one that's free of VOCs.
All right. Thank you, Jay and Peter. Next question. I'm interested in how installation of vapor barriers work with elevator pits from a construction perspective. Should a vapor barrier be placed beneath the entire elevator pit or somehow tied or anchored to the sides of the elevator pit? I'm concerned about elevator pits being installed prior to installation of a vapor barrier and assume this is not fully protective.
You know, it's timely that this question was asked because actually Peter and I were discussing this not that long ago. So I'll default to Peter, and if there's anything I can wrap up, I'll try to do my best to answer that.
Yeah, I mean, great question, Jennifer. Absolutely. You can install a system in an elevator pit. One of the things to keep in mind, and it came up earlier with one of Catherine's questions, is, you know, if you're developing it in a floodplain, then you have to deal with not only vapor, but you have to deal with water as well. Without getting into all the details, because elevator pits can be constructed a couple of different ways, but, you know, basically you want to have the barrier underneath the foundation of the elevator pit, as well as the walls. And there's a number of different ways to get that, to meet that objective, if you will. But it also comes down to how they're going to construct that elevator pit. That being said, it's very easy to do. And, you know, it's something we do every day, not trying to plug or anything, but the key is to understand how they're going to build those pits. And the biggest challenge is that those are the things that get changed a lot, meaning that they could be listed one way in the plans, but the general contractor can decide to construct them differently once they get to the field. I see it happen all the time. It's not something that's really given a lot of thought because they're relatively minor, but it is something that does get changed a lot. It is also one of the more common things that people forget about. So when they say we're going to do a mitigation system, the general contractor says, great, we'll plan for that. But they don't, they'll just go ahead and build their elevator pits. And we do come across that quite a bit as well. And, you know, really the only thing you can do there is if the elevator pit is already constructed, they've already backfilled against it. So, you know, when you're on a site, all you see is the pit itself. Really, an epoxy coating is really the only thing you can do in that situation.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly, Peter, that a lot of times people overlook that feature of a building and it gets neglected. I can talk about a recent example of how they installed a vapor barrier, or I should say underneath an elevator pit. So this was a new construction. Essentially, they laid down the base layer, sprayed the asphalt latex membrane type of core on it, and then they poured the concrete slab, the floor slab, and then they made forms for the concrete slab and essentially tied, once that cured, they tied the sides of the vapor barrier into that and spray applied the rest of it. So I think sequencing is important. I think in a more general sense, I think Peter's right. You know, just make sure that you understand how that sequence is going to work and how it ties in.
Thank you, Peter and Jay. That's all the time that we have for this portion of Q&A. So we will move on to the next section, but we will have one more Q&A portion at the very end. So with that, I am going to pass it off to John Boyer from GeoSynTech.
Hey, thank you very much, Devin. And good day, everyone. Yes, I do have control. Excellent. Everyone else in their pictures had mountains or nature scenes in the background. I have an actual one, and that is a picture drawing of Zion National Park. So if you're into national parks, then you might recognize that. Anyway, we're talking about system verification, operation maintenance and monitoring, and exit strategy. So up to this point, you've gone through VI mitigation. You've seen operation, you've seen the pathway is complete. You've designed and installed a mitigation system. And you may have even had a few public meetings, as fun as they can be. So what's left? Well, that's what this module is about. We're going to be talking about system verification, operation maintenance and monitoring, which is OM&M, and exit strategy. That's what we're going to be covering. But really what it comes down to is three basic questions. Is it working? Is it still working? And is it still needed? So let's look at those individually. And Devin, there we go. I was having problems not getting control. Okay, we'll go over the objectives. Our objectives for this module will be to touch on some of the key concepts at this phase, towards the end of everything, dealing with verification, OM&M, and exit strategy. Now, these concepts include verifying that, in fact, the VIMS is successful. Is it running properly like you had originally planned? Communicating with stakeholders, which is important throughout the whole process, but very important here towards the end. You're going to have to address any problems that develop with the system itself as you're monitoring and commissioning them. And you have to plan for the termination of the work of the system. When can we shut it down? And then above all, we really need you to understand the documents that ITRC has put together. There's 30 documents. I'm just going to be talking about four of them, two fact sheets, process fact sheets, in fact, and two checklists that cover post-installation and OM&M and exit strategy. So before we get into this, and Catherine stated this earlier, and I think Peter and Jay to some extent, there's certain pieces of information that is really critical that out front you get resolved. They include first, determining parameters are going to be utilized to verify the system is in fact working. Second thing being selecting appropriate performance metrics to establish first a baseline and then to use that baseline to compare future inspections. And then finally, you have to determine a scenario by which you would consider an exit strategy or termination to be appropriate. That could be groundwater levels are now below the VI screening levels. A soil source has been removed from the site. So all those come into play. And it's really important that this be done during the design phase. You've heard it already from my predecessors. But I have to give you a personal perspective on this. I mean, for 30 years, I worked for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. And I have to say, the biggest fights and biggest problems came about because those types of things, those three things, were not resolved in advance. And consequently, the regulators blamed the responsible party, who blamed the consultants. And at the top of all that, the residents felt that they weren't getting what they needed. So getting these things resolved in advance is very, very critical. So make sure that that's done, okay? Okay, the first document that we're going to be talking about is the post-installation fact sheet. Looks like I'm getting some feedback there. Anyway, so let's start with that post-installation fact sheet. It provides key consideration and testing for post-installation VIMS verification. So the heart of that document is really table 3.1. And that lists post-installation considerations and the relative impacts based on what type of mitigation you have. Is it active, passive, remediation, or rapid response technologies? Now, what it also does, this fact sheet, is it points out things that need to be considered in advance or during construction. For example, if subslab soil gas sampling is going to be part of any type of verification, then it would be logical to install sample ports in the slab in advance or as part of construction. So very important that you keep some of these things in mind. Verification, and that's the first question. Is it working? That's what we're asking. So before beginning or concurrent to the system testing, you should conduct a building survey and to also inspect the system. Make sure it matches up with what was originally in the design. And that should be done pre-construction and post-construction so that you can see any differences. There are factors in buildings that could impact on the effectiveness of the vapor intrusion mitigation system. For example, if you have poor building foundations or as we mentioned before with utility pipes, if they're not properly sealed, you're gonna have problems with gases bypassing the normal process. And thus the effectiveness of the VI mitigation system is gonna be a problem. So in addition, there has to be commissioning. Commissioning is basically a series of tests to confirm that the system is operating properly and it's meeting the mitigation objectives that were established during design, Everything's during design. So keep that in mind. That has to be set up in advance. And while it's not covered in here during our talk, you also have to keep in mind that there could be issues with permits that have been provided, building codes or industry standards that should be met. So it isn't always just what's in the design, but the design has to consider the need for the issuing permits or building codes that might be involved in this. Documentation, very important. You see what it says there. If you didn't write it down, it didn't happen. And that's ever so true. One of the ways to address this is building as-built drawings. What they put together in design isn't always what you see in the end product. Modifications need to be made. Things like suction points may have to be moved based on whatever the reason is. So the as-built drawings become very important. And then you're going through the verification performance. The data from that needs to be documented. Often the regulatory agency is looking for that kind of information. So documenting everything becomes very important in the process. So keep that in mind. Now I mentioned performance metrics. There's a couple of different ones and it depends on the type of mitigation that you've chosen to install in this system, in this building, whether it's passive or active. So let me give you some examples of performance metrics that could be used. You see up there a vacuum field or pressure differential across the slab, very typical for an active system. I think Catherine mentioned that. You could also be looking at system vacuum or airflow. They also are metrics that can be used to evaluate a system. If you're talking about smoke and tracer gas testing, in those cases, you're really looking at a passive system. And I think Jay and Peter mentioned the use of tracer gases. Indoor air sampling or soil gas sampling, that could depend on the agency that we're talking about, wherever you are. I know in New Jersey, we're definitely looking for indoor air samples to be collected for commissioning. And then based on the performance metrics, you may not have to go back and do indoor air sampling until the very end when you terminate. Each state has different requirements. So make sure that you check with your agency and see what they may require. Indoor air sampling is typical with passive systems. So don't be surprised if that comes up. And then institutional controls, long-term institutional controls, may be required for passive or active mitigation systems. This is a way of ensuring that the house is sold and suddenly someone didn't know that there's a mitigation system in the basement. So institutional control should come up when they do a check on the property. So that's often mentioned there. Now, if you go through the tech sheets, they will give you some ideas on performance metrics that might work for you on your particular technology. Post-installation verification checklist. This is the first of the checklists. Now, you're going to be using checklists as an easy way to document in writing what you're doing and to establish current conditions. Remember, documentation, very important. Checklist is an easy way to do that. Now, these checklists are really just templates that can be modified to meet specific requirements of state agencies, or maybe it might be site-specific needs. And as I'm not sure who it was, one of us earlier had mentioned that you may not answer all the questions. So it may not be applicable. So keep that in mind. So I'll go into a little more detail in checklist in one of my future slides. So it's that time, if it ever comes up. Go back, try it again. There it is. Okay. Our first knowledge check. When is it most important to develop verification procedures and an exit strategy? Should it be during the VI investigation, during mitigation design and planning, at the time of mitigation implementation, after construction, or never? Okay, let's see how the results come from that. So make sure you vote. Give you about 30 seconds. Devin will let me know when there's enough answers in there. And there we have it. During mitigation design and planning. Excellent. So you were listening to us. Now, a couple people put during VI investigation. At that point, you wouldn't necessarily know whether you have to do mitigation or not. You're still evaluating the site. So it wouldn't be during the VI investigation. It would really be during mitigation design and planning. So we can close that out and move on. Except it won't move on. The challenge of technology. There we go. Okay. Similar to the post-installation fact sheet, there's a summary table in the OM&M and exit strategy fact sheet. In this case, it's table 2-1. And it looks at the considerations and impact based on the type of mitigation, similar to the other, post-installation fact sheet. Thus, this table provides you with a snapshot, and the accompanying text that comes along with that helps to identify problems, but also confirms ongoing acceptable performance by the mitigation system. So, and there may be additional state-specific requirements. So as I've said before, talk to the regulators, get their buy-in in advance on OM&M and exit strategy so you don't run into problems later on. Okay, second question, is it working? Is it still working? Not only do you have to establish that the VI mitigation system is initially working, and that's the verification and commissioning, but you also have to periodically inspect the system to make sure that it's still working. And that's where the performance metrics come in. Is the system still meeting that baseline established from the performance metrics? If it is, then everything's fine. If you find that it's not quite matching it, then you have to properly investigate the system and figure out, why isn't it working? There must be something. You may have to make adjustments. Not uncommon at all. Keep in mind that you have to be transparent about this. You have to keep all stakeholders informed on what's going on. Now, it's nice to be able to say, it's working great, no problems, we're moving on. But you also have to inform them when it's not working well. Hopefully you'll have it resolved before you tell them it's a problem. But that's the idea, that sometimes, well, all the time, you have to keep people involved so that there's no questions later. Now, this is the table from the process fact sheet. We call it a rating system. You'll look at different categories and you'll rate how important each one is. Now, this type of information is also found in the design considerations, which Jay and Peter previously talked about. It's in post-installation fact sheet, as well as the OM&M and exit strategy fact sheet. Now, for this fact sheet, the OM&M exit strategy, there's an impact on depending on the particular type of mitigation that you're going to use. So you have there categories and principal considerations and subject matter. And then we use these Harvey balls. I never knew they were called that, but evidently that's what they're called, which based on the color of design will tell you whether we're dealing with a high impact, a medium impact, a low impact, or it's not relevant at all. So this gives you a quick snapshot of what you're dealing with by just glancing at it. Now let's go a little bit into that. It's great that you have those Harvey balls and it gives you a relative risk that we're dealing with, but it's much more than that in the fact sheet. So what we're looking at is not only the short, quick, high impact, low impact assessment, but there's also a narrative so that you can go into it. In this case, it's subgrade soil type, and look at them from a perspective of each of the mitigation types: active, passive, remediation, and rapid response. And you'll see active is high, passive is low. So it varies based on the type of technology. And the fact sheet will give you a narrative discussion on the relative importance and why one is high and one is low. Checklist. Okay. Now the checklist includes a list of considerations that are factors in the process and includes, again, system design and documentation, post-installation system verification, operation maintenance, and monitoring. So we're going to be talking about the two fact sheets related to this module, which is the post-installation and OM&M. Okay, this is a great opportunity to document the relative activities. So using that checklist, keep in mind this checklist allows you to make edible fields, fill in information, check off boxes. So if you go out in the field with a tablet, you have this on your computer, you set up one for each of the properties that you're going to look at, and you can fill it out right in the field. It's not a matter of writing on a piece of paper and then go back to the office and try to fill it out later. So that's really important, okay? Now, there's different categories, which is the top. In this case, we're talking about building conditions and use, but then we go into subheadings with primary prompt, you know, is there an HVAC system that's operating? Yes, no, not applicable. You can check the box. Going further, there may be opportunities where you have to record information. How many hours is the HVAC system running? In this case, 12. And then, of course, there might be conditional or secondary prompts with other questions that could follow up. Okay, let's move on. We're getting near the end now. The OM&M checklist, again, includes considerations that may be reviewed, inspected, and or measured during the OM&M site visit. When you do your inspection, it has all that information there. There's also a series of summary tables so that you can write down specific information such as the monitoring data for the metrics that are required. So the checklist is a great opportunity, again, to document what you're dealing with, and chances are you're going to be turning it over to the state regulators later, so it's a great choice. Then we get to the part we all like. system shutdown, which is the last question. Is it still needed? Do we need this VIMS at this point? But you have to plan for that, as we keep saying, and I will keep reiterating it. You have to plan up front. You have to think of the end product during the design phase to make sure that everybody is in agreement. All stakeholders have to agree on termination procedures as well as just what triggers termination. I can tell you in New Jersey where I worked, we had a requirement that the responsible party had to give the property owner, the homeowner, the option of keeping the system in even after it's no longer needed. Now, the responsible party doesn't have to maintain the system. They don't have to pay for electricity, which they do in New Jersey. But we also have a problem in New Jersey with radon. So these systems, as we just mentioned earlier, are very effective as a radon system. So in many cases, people say, just leave it in. But they also might say, I'm tired of looking at it, get it out of my house. And our PO or the consultant will have to remove it, repair any damages that were done. So keep that in mind. There has to be not only what triggers the termination, but what's the process for stepping out of it at that point. Okay, last knowledge check of today. Which is the most important post-installation verification measure? Vacuum field or pressure differential across the slab? Smoke tracer gas testing, indoor air soil gas sample results, system vacuum and airflow, long-term institutional controls, or it depends. Let's get your votes in there. And Devin, let me know when you have enough. And there we have it. It depends. Well, why does it depend? Remember what I had said earlier. Everything is based on the type of technology that you're going to use, the mitigation. Is it passive? Is it active? So that will weigh into it. It also depends on whether the state agency feels that there's a more appropriate way of doing that. So we'll close that out and move on. Maybe we'll move on. Okay, summary. Where have we gone? Well, this training module, we discussed key concepts from the post-installation and the OM&M or exit strategy process fact sheets and the checklist. We stress planning in advance. Like I said, begin at the end in mind when you're developing these. We talked about commissioning. We discussed that it's confirming that the system is in fact working like we originally designed it to work. We talked about monitoring. There has to be periodic inspections. And then we talked about exit strategy as part of the monitoring. You're going to be looking at that, seeing when it's ready for us to move on to the exit strategy and discontinue monitoring of the VIMS. So we come down to the same three questions. Is it working? Is it still working? And is it still needed? So with that, I will turn it over to Devin and let her take it from here.
Thank you, John. All right, we will start our third question and answer portion. All right, first question. How do you determine appropriate sub-slab vent line spacing for passive venting design?
Okay, that seems more for Jay.
I can take a stab at that too. So it's going to depend on what type of material you're using. But I know, like, for example, there's the low profile venting, which is about and basically a trenchless technology. It is 1 inch thick, 12 inches wide. The spacing for that is generally a minimum or maximum 50 feet on center. So it has a radius of influence of 25 feet. So you can space it approximately 50 feet on center within the building. Using pipe and gravel systems, I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, that's consistent with what I've heard. It's usually a 25-foot radius of influence, roughly. I think there are some calculations you can do to make sure that you're covering that. I mean, not just the spacing, but I think you can actually look at flow and see if there's a larger ROI that you can achieve. John might have some input on that.
No, I'll leave it to you guys.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Sure. I think we can move on, Devin.
Okay. Thank you, trainers, for answering that question. Next question. Wouldn't the raised foundation impose challenges to the tenants and people who frequent the building, especially during days with low airflow?
You know, I think the idea with the raised foundation, I'm not really understanding what challenges you're referring to, but from my perspective, the goal of a raised foundation is essentially to separate, you know, the building from the vapor source so that you have, you know, there's nowhere for vapors to build up. So I don't think that they're ever going to enter the building envelope if you have a raised foundation. That's my opinion on it.
I think maybe it's important to note that if you're relying on a constant and specific airflow to mitigate vapor intrusion, then in a low airflow day is going to put that into question, then an active system is going to be your mitigation answer, not a passive one.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer, Catherine. And one of the things I always ask anytime I see a mitigation approach is, you know, what are you relying on to be protective? I constantly ask myself that question when I'm looking at submittals.
All right. Thank you, trainers. Next question. For membranes, do they ever need to be replaced? How long do they typically last?
Peter, do you want to tackle that one?
There's not much that's going to break them down over time. They don't need to be replaced. Typical building design life is anywhere from 35 to 50 years. You know, there is a design life component to a building. When you think of, you know, what a lot of these membranes are made out of, they're made out of plastics. You know, obviously, there's an asphalt component as well. We do have a plastic problem in this world where we produce too much plastics and they're impossible to get rid of. So there's really nothing that's going to impact the integrity of the barrier once it's in place and protected by concrete.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. Next question. Some states require an evaluation regarding how long an active system can be down before repair and reactivation. How would you conduct this evaluation?
I'll try to take that. Again, based on my experience in New Jersey, we sometimes have power outages when Superstorm Sandy hit. Power is down for a length of time. And we had posted an answer on our website that basically said, for 1 or 2 days, it shouldn't be a problem. When you have an active system in particular, pulling vapors from the subsurface, it takes a while from diffusion and advection to get the vapors back up to the levels where they might impact on the indoor air. You also could have a situation where the active system can continue to some extent as a passive system. So everything involved, it's not a major problem. Now, as far as repairs and reactivation, repairs for the most part should not take long at all. If the fan dies, they're relatively easy to replace and put in a new one and then start up the fan almost immediately. There might be other problems that develop. And if it becomes too long, you can always do some type of rapid response, such as air filters or increased ventilation in the building. But for the most part, those are handled as it comes up.
And I think one addition to that, John, is something like an expectation around evaluating and reactivation is exactly the kind of thing that you can put in those design work plan products so that everyone's on the same page as to what your response time is going to be around different types of events.
Good point.
All right. Thank you, John and Catherine. We have time for one more question. How reliable are waterproofing membranes at mitigating VI when groundwater is too shallow to install a VIMS?
I'd say they're very effective. It depends on the waterproofing system that you're selecting. There are waterproofing systems out there that are rated or have testing for, you know, diffusion coefficients. So they do exist. And oftentimes they're more robust than I'd say your standard barrier that's being used to mitigate vapor intrusion. So, you know, they're very effective. Something actually we see a lot of in California, where there's shallow groundwater pretty much everywhere, and there's contaminated plumes almost everywhere, especially in Northern California. So something that's very common.
I do want to chime in and just make one note on that. Typically in construction, you can see vapor barriers, and vapor barriers are not always designed for the purpose of mitigating chemical vapor intrusion. So make sure you know what product you're referring to when you talk about a vapor barrier. Some of those materials are not designed to handle chemical vapor intrusion issues. But when you can look at something like a diffusion coefficient and make sure that that barrier has an appropriate diffusion coefficient for the contaminants that you're looking at. And that's a good check to make sure that you're using an appropriate product.
That's a really good point, Jay. I just wanted to add on the waterproofing too. Make sure that the waterproofing material is actually rated for the environment that you're in, such as there are some bentonite waterproofing boards and things that specifically say they cannot be used in chlorinated solvent environments and other items like that. And some of the confirmation that the waterproofing and everything is appropriate is proof in the pudding in terms of long-term sampling or confirmation sampling before occupancy and after.
The nice thing about if you're doing a foundation that's being built into groundwater, you can obviously identify any imperfections in the system pretty easily because essentially your tracer gas would be water coming through the wall. So there are, you know, sometimes some advantages to that as well.
Okay. Thank you, trainers, for answering those questions, and thank you to the attendees for asking them. I'd like to say a special thank you to the trainers for being here today and for contributing to the ITRC document. We would like to hear back from all of our attendees today, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on the last slide. Filling out the feedback form is how you will certify that you participated in order to get a certificate of completion for today's training. If you need any further clarification on answers or if you have any more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. So with that, that concludes our training for today. Thank you all for attending, and thank you, trainers.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone.